The bioenergy industry, like this diagram, is made of components. You may know everything there is to know about your individual little component, but unless you understand how those components are connected, you'll never understand the complete picture. Relative to the bioenergy industry, if you don't understand the complete picture, we will not have an opportunity to understand its impacts on soil or water. The Billion Ton Report and associated studies have raised some very high expectations of this industry, and our science is included in that. Expectations in rural America for rural development, economics, expectations in the halls of Congress as it relates to availability of liquid fuels to replace petroleum, and on Wall Street. When we ponder how this industry is going to develop, it's critical that we understand one key axiom. The dog barks, money talks, but natural resources have no voice. You do have a good memory, though. The industry offers us opportunities, it offers us challenges, and it offers us conflicts. Opportunity is given here. One of the challenges we deal with is that plant residue production is dependent on soil and water resources. These resources are only marginally renewable. And the conflict. This is the biggie. Plant residues that are required for the bioenergy industry, this is the cellulosic version, are the same plant residues that are required for soil and water conservation. Money versus natural resources. This leads me to two questions to present to you. First one is this. Do we have the science or have the scientific knowledge to identify acceptable removal rates? This is talking about cellulosic versions. The 1,200-pound gorilla is here. Can we balance the energy needs, the financial interests, and soil and water conservation in this bioenergy industry? If so, how are we going to do it? Does soil erosion, or what impact does soil erosion have on crop productivity? On the vertical axis here, we're looking at corn yield. On the horizontal axis, we're looking at depth of the A horizon. Two different soil types, Iowa soils, looking at corn yield. What happens as we move from right to left on that lower axis as we look at the thinning of the A horizon? What happens to productivity? Goes down. What happens to the thickness of the A horizon as soil erosion proceeds? It thins. Unless you are at the deposition position, in which case you probably already have fairly thick A horizon. Thick A horizon, you go to the top, we don't see much crop response positively to increasing the depth of that component. Reducing productivity through removal of residues is going to have a negative impact on the quantity of residues available. How many tons of residues are we expected to have based on the billion ton report? Lots. If we're going to produce that quantity, we have to maintain productivity. That's the soils component. Let's talk about water briefly. Okay, what are the primary pollutants, concerns relative to water quality? There are others: nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment. So, nitrogen, is water quality relative to nitrate improving, and if it is, at what rate? Okay, this is a point location, some information, Des Moines, Iowa. Nitrogen concentration on the vertical axis versus time on the horizontal axis. The yellow is the annual maximum concentration observed at the water plant in Des Moines, Iowa. The black line is the annual mean. Which direction are we headed? That's not a bioenergy component, but that is indicative of an agricultural industry that's under stress. The question is, will the bioenergy industry add to, detract, or improve that situation. Phosphorus is a little bit different critter than nitrogen. Phosphorus is less water soluble, it moves the soil particles, and relative to controlling or help water phosphorus problems, we want to reduce soil movement, sediment movement, and we want to ensure that the sediment that is moving is not extremely high in phosphorus content. Sediment, the other one of the three, is dependent upon soil erosion losses. To help with the sediment management, we want to hopefully ensure we have sufficient surface cover to intercept water raindrop energy, or we could produce structures, build structures for sediment capture. So what are the goals as we look to harvest of biomass, harvest of above ground components for nitrogen? Number one, reduce loads. Number two, increase uptake efficiency. Number three, with phosphorus, not three, number two, the second component, phosphorus, reduce load, loads applied to the land, limit soil erosion, and sediment is obviously to limit soil erosion. So as we progress through this presentation, consider these goals and see how we might meet them as we move into and through the lignocellulosic harvest activities. Okay, let's first look at nitrogen. I've got four different potential cropping systems or crop components, crops that could be used in this lignocellulosic industry, and I've associated with those the nitrogen recommendations. Nitrogen load is one of the goals for water quality purposes. Continuous corn. A lot of different N recommendation rates. I chose Minnesota, just pull it out of the hat. It's fairly representative, 134 to 174 kilograms per hectare. Switchgrass, New York recommendation, is about half that of corn. Hybrid Poplar is based on tissue test. Apply as needed. One paper suggests, recently published, that polycultures may not require much N at all. Which of those four is likely to move forward based on the vision for our dominant single species lignocellulosic feedstock? That's a mouthful. It's the one with the lowest nitrogen recommendation, right? Wrong. Yeah. Okay. So residue. Remember we talked about sedimentation and phosphorus is dependent upon soil erosion, a very generic graph showing the impact of residue cover. That on the horizontal axis versus erosion. Erosion is expressed as a percent of erosion that's occurring with 100% bare condition. Okay, as we go to the, let's look at that horizontal axis and start clear to the right, 100% residue cover. What happens to cover as we start removing residue? Okay, as that residue cover goes down, what happens to erosion rates? Who is going to decide how much residue we can remove, or better yet, who is going to decide how much erosion we're going to tolerate? Well, typically we're using the T value, which is a fairly politically hot issue in itself and scientifically controversial. Recent work suggests, and I'm not talking about carbon in this presentation, that if we use carbon as a metric to control residue harvest, we are going to be more constrained relative to the amount of residue that can be removed, more constrained than we will if erosion is the primary metric. So to address this erosion characteristic, we're going to look at the C value in the USLE. For the C value, the greater the number, the more erosion is going to be predicted by Russell or the USLE derivatives. Okay, so we want a low C value as we look at potential cropping systems that could be used in the lignocellulosic industry. Switchgrass, perennial cover, not switchgrass, perennial cover, switchgrass could be part of that, polyculture, CRP, take your choice. C value of 0.02. As we move to continuous corn, grain only, no residue removed, still a pretty small number, double what it is for the perennial cover. As we start removing residue, continuous corn, 75% residue removal, 0.16. We've increased by a factor of quite a bit. If we go to continuous corn, 95% residue removed, we increase by a factor of hoo-ha. Okay, that's one version of an estimate of cropping systems. Let's look at one other. That is, we've done some work with what we call the Iowa Daily Erosion Project. With this project, we've taken WEP, the NRI, and X-RAD radar, and combine the three of them so we can make estimates of soil erosion losses across the state of Iowa on a daily basis at the township level. NRI is used as our means of identifying management schemes on the land. What we're going to do in this next few slides is replace the NRI identification of whether we're growing corn, soybeans, wheat, hay. We're going to replace it completely across the landscape with 8 different rotations. Within those rotations or cropping systems, we have systems where we're removing residue. And we're going to show you pictorially and quantitatively what this model estimates would happen to soil erosion for a single day. I guess that's okay. Okay, the rotations that we're going to look at are given here. NRI, that's our base data. That's where we're starting from. Okay, we're going to superimpose on the landscape a corn-soybean rotation. Residue removal, nope. Cover crop, no. Continuous corn, minimum till. Residue removal, yes. Cover crop, no. Corn-soybeans, no till. No residue removal, no cover crop. On through the list. We're going to go through this list. The next sequence of slides shows you graphically what our erosion estimates would be for August 22nd, 2007. This is the rainfall distribution for that day. This is the estimated rainfall distribution based on our NEXRAD information. Statewide precipitation averaged 1.56 inches. The sequence of slides I'm going to show you starts with the system that give us the lowest erosion rates and progress through those systems to the maximum soil erosion loss. They're color-coded. This gives you the rainfall that you just saw. Color-coding for soil erosion loss, the brighter the reds, the greater the erosion loss, up to in excess of 7 tons per acre. Darker blues, no soil erosion or very low soil erosion losses, and the clear areas, there were no soil erosion losses predicted. Okay, so we start out with switchgrass, no-till residue removal. That is the lowest erosion estimate. Continuous corn, no-till. Continuous corn, soybeans, no-till. Continuous corn, no-till. This is the first one with residue removed. Continuous corn, no-till, residue removed with a cover crop. Greater losses. Whoa. Problem is, with continuous corn, how much time at the end of the season do we have to grow a cover, establish a crop? Very, very little. Long season hybrids. How do you put the cover crop in? You do a little bit of tillage. This is our base data, NRI data. Corn, soybeans, minimum till, higher yet. Continuous corn, minimum till with residue removal. Quantitatively, what's it telling us? If you take a look at that second column, that is the mean soil loss across the state for those different cropping systems. Top one, switchgrass, 0.04. The first residue removal is that of, or next in the list, is continuous corn no-till, quite dramatically increased, and down to the greatest, which was an order of magnitude greater than the switchgrass. So if we're looking to reduce sediment delivery, we're looking to reduce phosphorus delivery. Enough said. I can show you multiple studies, multiple publications that indicate based on climate change models we're going to see increased erosion and increased water runoff in the absence of biomass removal. This is the Hadley model, their prediction of precipitation change relative to what's happening now or recently. Blues indicate elevated precipitation levels, reds, deficit. We can argue with what a given model says because other models may predict something a bit different, all respected, all published. But without exception, they all indicate greater frequency of extreme events. Okay, model says that, but what does the data show? Okay, this is a paper published in 2005 in the Journal of Climate. Every researcher has to have a slide that's damn near incomprehensible. This is mine. So I'm going to tell you what it says rather than try to walk you through it. Their study looked at the frequency of very heavy rainfall events, the top 0.04, I think it was, percent of the events, from the period 1890 through 2002. In that period, from 1890 to 1970, there was no change in frequency of those extreme events. From 1970 to 2002, and this is in central U.S., 1970 to 2002, frequency increased 26%. Statistically significant between the two slopes at the 0.05 level. Models give us evidence that we see increased rainfall driving erosion events. Empirical data suggests that, and we're going to remove residue. So, thinking, boy, this guy is really down on bioenergy. No, he's not. I'm very positive about it. The lignocellulosic industry offers us the greatest opportunity for soil and water conservation since the breaking of the prairie. It honestly does. We have crops now that we can produce anywhere on the landscape, basically, and have a market for it. You could take anything on those in that picture and convert it to energy, including the guy standing there. It can be done. Multiple purpose, multiple function. It's a great opportunity for us. But we have to find ways to make it happen, or at least allow it to happen. I'm going to talk briefly about a couple connectors. Remember, we drew the lines around the Liberty Bell? There are things that are outside of our discipline that are critical players if we want to meet the goals of soil and water conservation and a healthy bioenergy industry. One of those deals with a conversion process. Different conversion platforms will be able to handle different types of residue materials. A conversion platform that will handle a very homogeneous feedstock will influence what a farmer produces. An alternative thermochemical or an alternative platform, right now it appears that it might be the thermochemical platform, will handle a much broader diversity of mixed material that goes into the process. This opens a door that otherwise might not be opened. One of the thoughts is, God, can this happen? I mean, isn't that tremendously expensive? Well, the engineers tell us, that this could happen even on a distributed basis. They're suggesting that the pyrolysis unit, the initial process, could be purchased for the price of a combine and actually be used in a distributed system. That gives you bio-oil, syngas, and a char. So it's seemingly possible. Another component, people have heard me say this so many times they're probably sick of hearing it, and that is land ownership profile. We have to decide, as a society, as a culture, are soil and water resources, or are they a form of capital to be exploited for short-term profit? A critical, critical question. In 2006, I know Iowa better than other states, I'm from there, 39% of Iowa farmland purchases were by investors. They were not by farmers who were going to farm that land. Why is this critical? Why is it critical? A person that's making a decision about how much residue to remove on a land resource that person may never farm again has a different long-term interest than somebody that's living, owning, and operating that resource and wants long-term sustainability and long-term profitability. The internal mechanism for controlling residue removal is basically gone. Who will regulate that? Who will control it? Don't know the answer. Harvested lands expressed the percent of those harvested lands that are rented. Iowa in 2002 is 56%. Probably something that's even more important is the type of leases that are being used. The percent of those leases that are cash rented, that are cash rent leases, have gone from 49% to 54% to 69% in the years 1982, 1992, and 2002. Why is that important? Cash leases tend to separate the decision of the landowner from the land manager. We have increasing number of short-term leases, one-year leases. Increasing incidence of sealed bids for rental lease amounts. Iowa's unique, right? Well, it is because other states have higher rental areas than Iowa does. Illinois, 62%. Indiana's 58%. I've got a buddy that's an ethanol distributor. Ethanol of a different kind. He works with Anheuser-Busch. In discussing this, he made a comment to me one day. He says, Rick, he says, I know nothing about agriculture, but he says, I understand that nothing accelerates faster, stops quicker, or corners harder than a rented car. My concern is that soils are natural resources that should not be treated like that rented car. But I have a fear that that may happen. Opportunity exists, but we also deal with very significant challenges that must be addressed. Do you connect the dots? You might know your points, but if you don't know how they relate one to another, it's tough to separate this from this. In summary, I want to leave you with a question. And that's this one. How do we balance energy needs, the financial interests, and soil and water preservation in the emerging bioeconomy? Thank you. The question is, on what basis do I suggest that we can put zero nitrogen on a polyculture? Is David Tillman here? That's not my suggestion. That's not my suggestion. That's basically, I don't want to say a quote from, but very close to a quote from an article that he published in the AAAS. Whether it can have, it's a mixed culture, it contains legumes, Right. A challenge with that study is the material in getting their results. The prairie was burned rather than harvested and material was removed. There's some challenges that were brought about because of that study, but it's there.
In the NIR modeling you had there, what percent residue were you removing on those figures?
Good question. 75% removal for both corn and switchgrass. Did everybody hear the question? What percent removal of residues were used in those studies?